From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. We're following a major moment in the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. After nearly 20 years, the U.S. military has pulled out of Bagram Airfield. That base was the epicenter of the American-led war to oust the Taliban and try to hunt down the al-Qaeda operatives who planned the 9/11 attacks. Bagram has been handed over to Afghan National Security and Defense Forces. And CNN correspondent Anna Corrin joins us now from Kabul. Anna, thank you for taking the time.
You're very welcome, Jane.
Anna, does this mean the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan announced by President Biden in April is now complete?
Well, certainly the U.S. and NATO forces at Bagram Air Base have departed the country. Two plane loads flew out Thursday night, another one first thing Friday morning. So they have handed Bagram Airfield back to the Afghans. There are about 4,000 Afghan National Security Forces at the airbase, and they are now in charge of what was, as you say, the epicenter of America's war here in Afghanistan.
And what will the remaining American troops be doing now in Afghanistan?
So there's up to about 1,000 U.S. forces who will remain in country. About 600 will protect the U.S. embassy. The remainder will help secure the international airport until Turkish forces come into place. It's a tiny footprint compared to what was here at the height of the war, more than 100,000 U.S. forces here in 2011. You know, the training, assisting, advising that the Americans have been doing, fighting alongside the Afghans, that has now all ended. It will be financial aid to the tune of $3.3 billion in security assistance to Afghanistan over the coming year. And then, of course, that air support, that critical air support that America says will be on offer, airstrikes for certainly terrorist targets. But if, let's say, the Taliban threatens to topple provincial capitals, the United States says that it won't hesitate to step in.
And aren't there still questions about security at the airport in Kabul, Anna, and what's going to happen there?
Look, I think it's fair to say that there's questions about security everywhere in Kabul. We've been here for the last couple of days, and it's relatively quiet. But whilst we were interviewing Dr. Abdullah yesterday at his residence, he being the leader of the peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, we heard a bomb go off. This is just commonplace in Kabul, but certainly, it's in the districts, in the outer areas, and particularly in the north, where the Taliban is launching its offensive. It currently holds more than 50% of territory, and whilst they haven't claimed any provincial capitals, you know, they're just outside Kabul, you know, 10, 15 kilometers outside the capital.
So where does this leave the Taliban? They're fighting, they're taking over territory as we speak. I mean, there must be concern that they might be able to take over Afghanistan again.
Absolutely. And I think that's a genuine fear. The Taliban released a statement upon learning that U.S. and NATO forces had left Bagram, saying that this was a positive step and that it was now up to the Afghan people to decide their future. But in our conversation with Dr. Abdullah yesterday, he said that they have no intention of power sharing, of really holding proper peace talks that have absolutely stalled. There has been no progress there for months. And we saw that U.S. intelligence report just last week, which indicated that the Afghan government could topple within 6 months after U.S. forces leave. You then had General Austin Scott Miller say that if conditions continue to deteriorate, that there could be civil war in Afghanistan. And you know, speaking to local Afghans, they said that now was not the time for America to leave, that the situation is just too unstable. And there is now a mass exodus of people who want to flee the country. Obviously, you know, the translators, people who work with Americans, that they are desperate to get out. And you know, certainly the United States is trying to facilitate in this gargantuan task. But for normal Afghans, you know, people who are educated and perhaps were the future of this country, they no longer see a future here. And as one Afghan friend said to me, the first window that he gets, he will be out of here and not stay 1 hour longer in this country.
CNN correspondent Anna Koren is in Kabul for us. Anna, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Hurricane Elsa could make landfall in Florida early next week, which is just the latest threat, making the rescue effort at the collapsed condo building in Surfside even more precarious. 20 people are now confirmed dead. 128 are still missing. That number has dropped as officials get more information about who was in the building when it collapsed. Many family members at this point are losing hope, and President Biden reflected that feeling of agony when he visited families yesterday.
It's bad enough to lose somebody, but the hard part, the really hard part, is to not know whether they're surviving or not, just not have any idea.
NPR's Adrian Florido is in nearby Miami Beach. And Adrian, I know you've been to this site. Well, what have the workers said about how they're going to deal, first of all, with this storm?
Well, the storm's path is still very uncertain, but if it does impact southern Florida, that would be a huge setback for the rescue and recovery efforts that are still underway. Emergency officials are saying that they are prepared to deal with multiple emergencies or disasters in the state at the same time. But you can imagine how strong winds, let alone hurricane force winds and rain, would complicate the rescue efforts that have been slow and tedious because of, you know, the structural instability of both the pile of rubble and the part of the building that did not collapse.
We're into day 9 now of this rescue effort. Officials are still insisting that there still could be people alive underneath the rubble. But, you know, I've spoken with a family member who said he had no hope of seeing his mother or his grandmother alive again. From your sense, what's the mood there?
More people are feeling that way. Yesterday, there was, though, a lot of frustration, both by families of the victims and by rescue workers, because the portion of the tower that did not collapse started to shift, and so rescue efforts had to stop for more than 14 hours. And after 9 days, every minute, every second is precious if you're talking about finding someone who might still be alive. And so you can imagine the agony of being sidelined for more than half a day. Those recovery efforts finally resumed just before 5 o'clock last evening, and officials said rescue workers were eager and excited to get back to work. And then this morning, things are somber again after we learned that the body of the 7-year-old daughter of a Miami firefighter had been recovered.
Mm. Well, on top of that, as you've hinted at, this building, the part of it that still remains, they're now talking about demolishing it. It's too unstable, and there's fear that moving rubble could create an even greater collapse. I just wonder how rescue workers are taking all of that into account.
Well, they're taking everything into account very carefully, we're told. Engineers are monitoring both the rubble pile and the still standing portion of the building constantly. Yesterday, a FEMA engineer told us that they will be taking that remaining portion of the building down, but they're still considering their options for how to do it without disturbing that debris pile because of how determined they are to continue searching not only for survivors, but at the point where there is no more hope for survivors to recovering bodies and remains. So we do know that it'll take weeks, though, because of how complicated that process is going to be.
Yeah. Do you know how families have responded to the president's visit?
From what we're hearing, very well, generally. I haven't had a chance to speak with families since his visit, but he met with families for more than 3 hours yesterday. Most of what we heard from officials and rescue workers was that, you know, people were comforted by the president's empathy, but also by, you know, the president's promise that the federal government is giving full support to this recovery and rescue effort, and that 100% of the costs to this response of this disaster are going to be covered by the federal government for at least the next month.
A Miami-Dade County judge placed the Towers South Condo Association into receivership today. Tell us about that and what it means exactly.
Well, what it means is that an independent receiver is going to be handling the condo association's finances while the court hears lawsuits related to the building's collapse. Five lawsuits have already been filed. There are more expected. And the judge handling this said that, you know, it would allow an independent party with no financial or emotional stake in the tragedy to step in and basically take care of business. We learned that the condo association's insurance covers claims up to $48 million. There will probably be more money available when you take into account the value of the land. And the receiver has been authorized by the judge to begin issuing payments of several thousand dollars to the affected families, both for housing assistance and for funeral costs.
We have just about 40 seconds here, but what else can you tell us about some of those concerns that people had about the building before its collapse? Are we learning any more about that?
There still aren't a lot of clues about what led to the collapse. Investigators are going to be looking at all kinds of possibilities, from construction errors to delayed repairs, potentially, to the, you know, possibility that there were issues with the ground beneath the building. But we do know that at least some of the residents of the building had been frustrated by the slow pace of repairs that a consultant had identified a couple of years ago. And learning today, for example, that 2 years ago, the president of the condo board resigned because she was upset at the slow pace of repairs.
NPR's Adrian Florido, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thanks, Peter.
When military analyst Andrew Bacevich was writing his book last summer, the nation was dealing with a pandemic and a racial reckoning. There were also wildfires and hurricanes. It did feel like we were on the edge of an apocalypse. But what do we do now, given the threats that we face? Andrew Bacevich says pulling out of Afghanistan is a step in the right direction. He is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam. His new book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. He joins us now on Skype. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Talk first about what you describe in the book as the apocalypse of 2020. What fault lines did it expose in our country?
We came face to face with the limits on our government's ability to respond expeditiously and effectively to problems. And here, of course, in my judgment, a major problem was the incompetence of the Trump administration, which simply was totally ill-equipped to respond to this convergence of issues.
You talk a lot in the book about this idea of American exceptionalism, which really goes back to the beginnings of our country, this idea that the United States is an indispensable nation. But you write that the toxins of American exceptionalism have seeped into the body politic. And I'm curious, with this last year as a backdrop, what you mean by that and how has that led us in the wrong direction?
The most vivid illustration of the problem are the events that occurred on January 6th of this year. There was a violent effort to overturn the results of an election, which was a direct assault on the Constitution. That was, I think, the ultimate symptom of things that had gone badly wrong. You know, my particular interest is on U.S. foreign policy, in particular the use of American military power. So it's been my view, basically since the end of the Cold War, we have been engaged in a pattern of recklessly misusing American military power. And I think to some degree, the chickens came home to roost in 2020. And I would emphasize here that the pattern of misusing American military power was absolutely bipartisan. This is not it is not a matter of one party or the other taking us down the wrong road. They took us down the wrong road arm in arm.
So this pattern of recklessly misusing military power, let me dig into that a little bit. You talk about the American political establishment clinging to an obsolete national security paradigm, which stems from the conviction that we focus on everything out there, on security out there in Europe, in East Asia, in the Persian Gulf, with the security of people at home, something of an afterthought. It sounds a lot like former President Trump, who famously called for America first, and now President Biden is using the phrase America is back. Talk about that and what you're arguing for. Is it something in between?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but perhaps it is. But first of all, let us understand that President Trump used that phrase, America first, because he found it politically convenient. I don't think he even understood the historical antecedents of that phrase. And certainly, as president, he never had any coherent strategic sense of how to translate that phrase into a set of policies. So America First was theater. President Biden has given some indications of wanting to pursue a return to rationality. I mean, I'm talking here about rejoining the World Health Organization, of rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, of attempting to negotiate the restoration of the Iran nuclear deal. And we should give him credit for all of those things. That said, more broadly, he buys into the pre-Trump status quo. What's the evidence? Well, the evidence is a total absence of any serious rethinking of our military commitments. I should amend that. He wants to get us out of Afghanistan, but insisting that we will stay in Europe, insisting that the Asia-Pacific region is now emerging as an area of confrontation, the basis of what people are calling a new Cold War. I would argue there needs to be a rather explicit recognition that the most important threats to our well-being, yours and mine, your families and mine, are things that occur here in North America, within our own hemisphere. The threats that matter are environmental change and disease and insecure borders. Those are the places where there needs to be greater attention and investment, which implies let's take money away from the Pentagon, let's give money to some other government agencies that are more directly involved in taking care of us here.
So U.S. policy today should be more focused on our neighbors to the north and the south, Canada and Mexico. So to your mind, what would that look like exactly? And what would the benefits be?
I think the benefits would be to provide for a safer and more secure environment for your family and for my family. And let me emphasize, to argue that we should rethink our global military footprint, that's not an argument for isolationism. It is an argument that says that our engagement in the world, particularly since the end of the Cold War, has been excessively militarized. We need to engage with the rest of the world, but we should be engaging with the rest of the world in ways that emphasize diplomacy and economic interaction.
With regard to national security, Mr. Bacevich, you have said that we could still be living in the 1970s or the 80s, that there's no redefinition of security that would lead to a substantial redistribution of resources based on the needs that we have now, based on the needs of our time. So to your mind, what is a blueprint for changing our national security paradigm to better serve us?
Step number one is to have a serious conversation about what the threats are. Climate change is a threat to our way of life. We've learned over the course of the past year that we are threatened by diseases. We've already taken for granted the fact that 600,000 Americans died in the COVID pandemic. That's, I think, 150,000 more than were killed, soldiers killed in World War II. It's an astonishing figure. That's a danger that needs to be addressed. We've got problems on the border. I am not anti-immigration. If anything, I am pro-immigration. But the relationship between ourselves and Mexico, centered on undocumented people coming from Central America, is a catastrophe. And certainly there is a need to get smarter on how to deal with that, and also a willingness to devote more resources. Let us not forget nuclear proliferation. The Obama administration initiated a nuclear modernization program where the price tag is going to be about $1.5 trillion. Didn't get talked about. Why are we doing that? So I think there's a need for a basic conversation about what poses a threat to us where we live and what's the best way to deal with those threats.
How has the resurgence of American populism affected our governance in this country and really the specific needs of our people to which you just referred?
Well, I mean, in my judgment, the country is more divided today than it has ever been in my lifetime. Actually, I think that's probably not a very controversial statement. And so there absolutely is a need to find a way to restore a shared sense of the common good to which all of us can subscribe, regardless of race, regardless of class. And it's hard to see within the political establishment, and this is not just Biden, but within the national political establishment, maybe even it's hard to see within the intellectual class, a willingness to call a ceasefire and to find a way to restore the sense of unity that the nation absolutely needs. And there too, you know, if we say, well, if we compare that to, relate that to the national security question, I don't think fighting more foreign wars is going to bring the country back together again. Indeed, I think misguided foreign wars contributed substantially to the divisions that we're confronting today.
So it sounds like you're not terribly optimistic in this regard about the future.
I'm not. I mean, one of the things I said in my book is I don't think I'm writing these days in particular for my contemporaries, you know, the baby boomers. I think we are passing on a heck of a mess to the younger generation. And I think the best we can do is to try to begin prompting them to appreciate the importance of thinking anew. And I think that if they're going to be able to take on the challenges that face the nation, whether we're talking about climate change challenges or we're talking about, you know, white nationalist challenges, I think there's absolutely a need to rethink the national security paradigm as we go forward.
Andrew Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
COVID-19 has killed more than 400,000 people in India. Only the United States and Brazil have reported more deaths. NPR's India correspondent Lauren Freyer joins us now. Lauren, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we've spoken to you a couple of times in recent months about just how bad this pandemic has been in India. We're reading that half of these 400,000 deaths have been in just the last 2 months alone. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, more people died in India's second COVID wave than of COVID in all of 2020 in India.
Wow. So what explains it?
Yeah, India had the biggest and deadliest COVID-19 outbreak in the world in April and May. And we're still trying to, you know, tabulate the extent of the deaths from that. And by the way, that 400,000 figure is likely a vast undercount. Statisticians say the real figure could be 1 million, 2 million, maybe more. They believe that the government really only was able to record like a fifth or a sixth of the deaths from COVID-19. Hmm. And the same for infections. You know, random antibody tests show that many, many more people got infected in India than the government figures show. And here's why. Like, basically, testing capacity reached its limit in India in April and May. Testing centers ran out of kits and were finding like tens of thousands of excess deaths that were never attributed to COVID-19.
Wow. Lauren, each time we've spoken in the last couple of weeks or months, we've talked about the vaccines and how India has lagged behind, had some real trouble getting people vaccinated. Has that changed at all?
You know, the government says more supply is coming online, but still, it's just over 4% of people in India are fully vaccinated. The country is administered 340 million shots. Like, that sounds like a whole lot. But most of those are first doses, and the vaccines used in India require two doses. And India has nearly 1.4 billion people. Wow. Today, Mumbai, where I live, the vaccine centers had to close after just 3 hours. They ran out of supply. Yesterday, that happened in three whole states in India. India's the biggest vaccine maker in the world, actually. But public health experts say there was just this series of missteps that have led to shortages. And so the challenge now is to vaccinate people before the next wave. And scientists say, it's not if, it's when. They're predicting another wave of COVID-19 will hit India in a matter of months.
You know, it's such a good reminder that it feels like we're emerging from the pandemic here in the United States. It is not over at all in many other places across the globe. So what does it feel like in India right now?
Yeah, so local lockdowns are lifting. In Mumbai, restaurants have reopened, but they're only allowed to be open until 4 p.m. and only on weekdays. Masks are still mandatory. Police like zoom around on motorbikes and will stop you if you're out on the street without a mask. You have to pay a fine. Schools are still closed. Like, kids in India have not been to school since March 2020. A lot of people are still working from home. The Taj Mahal reopened. That's a big symbol, but no tourist visas have been issued in India since March 2020. I mean, I think this whole experience in South Asia shows us, as the West puts COVID behind us, many countries are just seeing wave after devastating wave as they struggle to get vaccines.
NPR's India correspondent, Lauren Freyer, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We have some sad news to report from the Cherry Hill neighborhood in Baltimore. Last night, a man named Kenyell Wilson was shot and killed, another victim of gun violence that is on the rise in cities across the country.
Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott is calling on Baltimore police to make the city's most recent murder case a top priority. Wilson, who also went by the name Benny, was a worker with the Safe Streets office in Cherry Hill.
As part of the Safe Streets program, Wilson helped mediate conflicts before they turned deadly. He is the second Safe Streets worker to die this year. And what makes this story all the more difficult is that just yesterday, I spoke with one of Wilson's colleagues. Hours before the shooting, Troy Bradley told me that the neighborhood had gone a full year without a homicide.
When you think of it, it's kind of sad, to celebrate, but it's reality, and it's not nothing sad to celebrate.
That celebration has now shifted to mourning. We tried to reach back out to Troy. Understandably, on a day like today, we could not reach him. But we are going to run yesterday's interview anyway as a reminder that peace anywhere can be fragile. Here's Troy Bradley explaining how the Cherry Hill Safe Streets program had found success.
We have what we call violence interrupters. Place in a target area. A target area is an area that, have got high-risk individuals hanging in that area. And a high-risk individual is a person who is potentially to get shot or potentially to shoot someone. And so we place a violence interrupter in that area, and that violence interrupter that we place in that area is from that area, grew up in that area, and has street credibility in that area. But that violence interrupter has to be clean. It can't just be an active person that's in the streets that we're going to get to squash beef. These persons are, former street men that still have that street credibility. And they do what we call ear hustle. They eye hustle. They bring that information back to the briefing table. This briefing table is confidential. It doesn't go to the police. So we take that information, such as, someone smacked Antoinette's sister. Well, we know Antoinette got two brothers that's actively in the gangs. So what do we got to do? We got to get ahead of that, because typically in our neighborhoods, things go from simple as a fight leads to a shooting or a homicide. So we get ahead of that, and we get to the uncle. We get to whoever we got to get to, and whoever had the best rapport, which 9 times out of 10, one of us have, because we all from that neighborhood. So we reach out and use our resources and our street credibility to say, hey, man, we heard, man, your nephew, was robbed at a dice game. What can we do? you know, to stop this, because we can't, you know, we can't allow this, you know, to take place. We got to stop this. So these are the tactics that we use to mediate conflicts and get ahead of the conflict. That way it won't lead to a shooting or a homicide.
You mentioned it's got to be somebody with street cred, someone like you.
Yeah.
You've been in prison. You've been shot. You know, do you need that background and that life story that you've got to make a program like this work?
It has to take, you know, one of your own, because, you know, that's the only way that you can engage with a high-risk individual. Sure, you can come into my community and you can be positive. You can throw events. And the community is going to be receptive to that. They're going to say, I like Mr. John. He's a nice man. But can Mr. John stop the violence? Can he infiltrate the hearts and minds of the high-risk individuals with a cookout, with giving away giveaways? Can he do that?
Right. No, I hear you. So what is it about you or someone like you that can go to that uncle who may be considering getting revenge for his niece that got slapped or beat up?
The someone like me is the person, there's a term that they say, we cut from a different cloth. I'm cut from that cloth. I have the resume. So when I come to them and I'm looking for a favor or I'm looking for some information, it's not a doubt in their mind that this information is going to go any further. He know why I'm here. He know what my mission is. He know what side of the fence that I live on now. He know I'm simply trying to get ahead of this, but I need certain information from him that you can't get. Only I can get it.
So tell me how your neighborhood has changed since you were growing up there and how it's changed since this program has been put into place. I mean, I assume you believe that what you're doing here is the reason you haven't had a homicide in the past year.
No, I know that's why we haven't had a homicide, because I come from that community. I know what that community once was. But not only that, I participated in those things that happened in those communities coming up in the early 90s and things like that. And that was a community that was once nicknamed Baby Afghanistan. So when you speak of those years up to these current years, 2021, there's a huge change in the Cherry Hill community. Right now, I can 100% say to you that there is no conflict towards no side, towards no young man against the other in the Cherry Hill community.
I'm speaking with Troy Bradley with the Safe Streets program in the Cherry Hill neighborhood of Baltimore. The neighborhood has gone a year without a homicide. And Troy, I want you to zoom out now, if you could, because your city is seeing more gun crime, just like many other American cities. What kind of lessons can you bring from Cherry Hill for other places? What do you tell people?
First, I would tell them, be serious about it yourself. We try hard to change our lives personally. Then when you're doing those things in the community, when you telling a young man do something, you not doing it, when you sneaking in, you selling drugs on the side, then that type of energy can't come off you when you delivering that message. It's a person that lives that message that it comes off of, and is 10 times effective than the hypocrite. And on top of that, you have to be involved. And I believe that Safe Streets is the best fit for that, because they use guys like us. We can go to the Bible. He ain't go and get no professor. He ain't go and get, he went and got somebody from the dirt. He went and grabbed right out the mud because he knew it would take one of their own. And giving us this program, injecting those trainers into us, injecting the Safe Street message to us, we go right back out there and give those injections right back to the community.
You know, I was talking to your mayor, Brandon Scott, last week. He was on his way to the White House because President Biden is making gun violence a priority and the president's trying to fund programs like yours in other cities. And I asked the mayor about the murder of Dante Barksdale, who was a leader in your organization, who, you know, as you know, was shot to death in East Baltimore last January. Here's what the mayor said.
Dante died doing what he did, trying to prevent someone from taking someone else's life. And we owe it to him to build upon his work and expand his work through the legacy of what we're trying to do, because we know it works. It's been proven to work.
So it sounds like it is working in your neighborhood, but there are still problems. I mean, there are still murders happening just outside the boundaries of your neighborhood. Just wonder how losing Dante Barksdale made your work harder and maybe demonstrates the challenges that you're facing?
Well, I want to comment, you know, first before I answer your question on, you know, the beginning of your statement. And when it comes to other parts of the city, this is the beginning stage. You know, this program is still in its infancy stages. You have programs that, you know, haven't even been up 2 years, and you're expecting them to perform, you know, and run neck to neck with programs that have been here 20 years. So you have to give a program time to develop. But how did Dante Boxdale's death affect? It affected some of us in different ways. Like I tell anybody who goes through death, if you had a chance to talk to that person, they wouldn't want you to be crying all the time and broke down and can't go forward. You know, they would want you to, you know, wipe those tears off your face, you know, reach the aim and get to where we was going at. You know, don't give up. So we're not going to break down and, you know, allow this thing to crumble, say Shreeks. But instead, you know, to give us strength to keep going and moving forward.
Troy Bradley is violence prevention coordinator for Baltimore's Safe Streets program in the Cherry Hill neighborhood of that city. Troy, thank you very much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
No problem, sir.
And again, last night, after we taped our interview with Troy, one of his colleagues, Kenyell Wilson, was shot and killed. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott said that Benny, as he was known, epitomized redemption.
The Supreme Court's decision to uphold Arizona voting restrictions has dealt a big blow to the Voting Rights Act. Yesterday's decision is the second in the past 8 years to weaken the law, which was a cornerstone of civil rights legislation passed in 1965 that sought to ensure every citizen had equal access to the ballot box. The 6-3 vote at the High Court fell along ideological lines, with the court's liberal justices dissenting. Joining us now is Wendy Weiser, Vice President of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So the Arizona law banned the collection of absentee ballots by anyone other than a relative or caregiver of the voter. There was another provision that discards ballots cast in the wrong precinct. How widespread are those problems across the country to your mind, and how will that impact other states?
Well, the real damage from the decision isn't the impact on those two policies. Those policies exist in some other states. They are not that widespread. The real damage comes from how the court issued its decision. It was a very sweeping decision that announced a whole new set of standards for determining when voting standards and laws are discriminatory and ought to be blocked or raise concerns under the Voting Rights Act. And so those two provisions were discriminatory according to the lower courts as functioned in Arizona. And they found that they disproportionately impacted Native American, Latino, and African American voters in Arizona, that they were actually intentionally designed to do so. The Voting Rights Act was sensitive to the social and historical conditions of where each of these voting restrictions were adopted. Now, all of that has been thrown out, and we have a whole new test for determining when it is that a law is discriminatory that is much harder to meet.
Well, that's interesting, because there have been a number of new voting restrictions put in place across the country after the 2020 election, even though there was no evidence of any widespread fraud or irregularities or problems in that election. And states now are pushing these laws, saying they're needed to prevent fraud. So what does yesterday's court decision mean for any future challenges to voting restrictions in any other state?
This decision could not come at a worse time. We are facing one of the worst waves of restrictive voting laws, of efforts to roll back access to voting across the country since the Jim Crow era. And it's a big fight in states across the country for democracy and voting rights in America.
Back up a little bit, Wendy, and give us a little history of the Voting Rights Act. Remind us why it was passed and what the law laid out.
Well, the Voting Rights Act was the crowning achievement of the civil rights movement. It was intended to eliminate Jim Crow barriers to voting that had restricted political participation by especially African-American voters across the country. And there were two main ways in which it went about that. The first, embodied in Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, was a pre-clearance regime. What it provided was that in certain states and localities that had a history of discrimination in voting, they were not going to be able to implement new changes to their voting rules until it was checked by either the Department of Justice or a federal court to make sure it was not discriminatory. And the Supreme Court completely gutted that protection in 2013, that most powerful protection. The second main protection in the Voting Rights Act was Section 2, the provision that was damaged yesterday. And it allowed for voters to go to court to challenge discriminatory laws that either were intended to or had the result of giving minority voters less of an opportunity to vote than all other voters. So those were the two twin provisions. The first one was eviscerated, at least for now, unless Congress steps forward. The second one now has been dramatically weakened. The nationwide prohibition on discrimination still remains. There will still be avenues for litigation and for courts to work out and how to protect voting rights, but it will be much harder going forward.
So Democrats in Congress are trying to pass new voting rights legislation. It's called the For the People Act. It's stalled in the Senate. You say that there are still some protections from the Voting Rights Act, but to your mind, is new legislation needed to restore what's been lost, what's been gutted from the Voting Rights Act at this point?
Absolutely. I think that we're not going to be able to ensure free and fair elections, and that every American can vote free from discrimination and unreasonable burdens unless Congress steps up. And there are two pieces of federal legislation that are pending now. The first is, as you mentioned, the For the People Act. The second piece of legislation is the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. That would strengthen the Voting Rights Act. And I think that after yesterday's decision, there is going to be an effort to strengthen Section 2 even more. And I think that that will be something that Congress addresses in the John Lewis Voting Rights Act as well.
Wendy Weiser is Vice President of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.